Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world and finding what inspiration I can in them for fantasy role-playing games. We've been doing inter-season special episodes for a while, but it's now time to begin our new season of Patron Deities, although, as we will see, it may not be a very long one, but who knows, maybe it will. We'll find out together. As you may be aware, this season is about the Phoenicians, and this episode is all about the social and historical background of the Phoenician culture. What does it mean to say the Phoenician culture? Is there more than one Phoenician culture? Well, yes, there is. What mythology am I talking about when I talk about the mythology of the Phoenicians? As always, a disclaimer for this subject, I am not an expert on the religion or cultures of ancient Phoenician cities, and I'm probably gonna oversimplify some things, get some things wrong. In these later seasons, I am very much learning about these cultures, and hopefully we're gonna learn about them together. So, as I said, we're gonna take a look at the historical and cultural background of Phoenicians. You can't really say Phoenicia, there's no such thing. And next week, we'll start looking at religion specifically. So let's start with the basic question. Who are the Phoenicians? So first off, Phoenician is not a name that this people ever used to describe themselves. It is what is called an exonym. So an exonym is when the name for a group is actually a name that other people call them. So an example of an exonym would be like Apache or Iroquois, which is an exonym for the group that today we would call the Haudenosaunee. So Greek writers referred to this group as Phoenicians. It's a word that comes from the word for the famous purple dye exported by the Phoenician city of Tyre. What did the Phoenicians call themselves? Well, I don't think we know. Insofar as they called themselves anything, it may have been a word related to, like, Canaanites, but they may not have really understood themselves as having a kind of collective identity, because they were never any kind of unified polity. So different Phoenician cities were completely independent of one another and indeed were frequently rivals. We're talking about cities that are united by a common language, that have common cultural elements and sort of a common religion, although we'll get to that. And in some cases, they share a common overlord, and we'll also get to that. But what term they used to distinguish their culture from, say, the cultures of Greek-speaking people, I don't know. It's very possible that they mainly saw themselves as citizens of Tyre or Byblos or Sidon or wherever, because that is what we are really dealing with when we look at the political organization of Phoenician culture, a network of city-states originating on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, many of them in and around what is today Lebanon, each ruled by its own government, often under the hegemony of some greater power. So for instance, we see periods where many of the bigger Phoenician city-states are kind of answerable to the kings of Egypt, or later on, Assyria or Babylon, and then ultimately Persia. As I mentioned, these city-states shared a common language. They also shared a common writing system, an alphabet that was the ancestor of the modern alphabet. That is to say, the Latin alphabet. Obviously, there are multiple modern alphabets, but you know what I mean. When we talk about Phoenician history, we can divide it into two very rough phases. One in which the Phoenician world is sort of focused on the cities of the eastern Mediterranean, which rise to prominence sometime around 1550 BC and kind of fall out of power around the Hellenistic period in the 4th century BC. But then in the later part of the period, we have Phoenician cities in the western Mediterranean becoming more important. There's a later empire in North Africa that arises from what was originally a colony of Tyre, but eventually becomes its own autonomous polity, and that is Kart Hadasht. So Kart Hadasht literally just means new city, Kart city, and we are more familiar with it by the English version of its Latin name, Carthage. So this became its own center of power sometime around the 5th century BC, and of course wound up getting defeated by the Roman Empire in the Punic Wars. And sometimes to distinguish between the early and later parts of this period, I may talk about those early cities as being Phoenician and then later on refer to the Carthaginian kind of period as Carthaginian or Punic. Now, I've talked about these city-states as though they were just like isolated city-states. Obviously, that's not true. Like any ancient city-state, they controlled inland communities that provided agricultural produce, but the majority of their power and economic prosperity came from trade and manufacturing. Big trade industries included textiles. So I mentioned, for instance, that Tyre was famous for its purple dye. So dyeing and exporting cloth was one of the major industries of these city-states. Another important export was timber. As you can imagine, if they're in Lebanon, cedar was an important export. And one of the very first written records we have of Egyptian interaction with a Phoenician city-state comes from a letter sent by an Egyptian official who had been sent by the king to go trade for cedar in the Eastern Mediterranean. So I mentioned knowing Carthadasht better by its Latin name, and I mentioned this Egyptian source describing what's going on in, I think he's in Sidon. He's actually in more than one place, but I think Sidon's one of them. You'll notice that I haven't mentioned reading any Carthaginian or Phoenician sources. And the reason for that is that compared to their neighboring linguistic communities, so compared to the Greek world, compared to the Latin-speaking or Persian or Assyrian or Babylonian or whatever worlds, we have very few textual sources from the Phoenician world. So we have a lot of, or at least a certain number of, inscriptions. We have a pretty good understanding of the kinds of texts written on monuments and things, but we have very few kind of preserved documents, so not like things that are on papyrus or whatever. Frustratingly, I believe it's in Carthage, there is a site where we've turned up large numbers of papyrus seals. So we know, that is to say, they're like the clay seals that held papyrus documents. So we know that there were these paper documents being stored in some kind of archive, but they have not survived. So a lot of our written knowledge about the Phoenicians comes from non-Phoenician sources: Greek, Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Persian, Roman, and of course from the Bible. And a good amount of Phoenician content in the Bible. All that talking about Tyre and Sidon and what have you, that's all relevant. It's actually very weird when you're reading the history of this region to constantly be returning to individuals that you are used to mainly thinking of in a religious context. So there was something about, you know, yes, under the reign of King Solomon, this thing happened. Now, you may say, but James, there's a lot of kind of ahistorical content in even those historical sections of the Bible, to which one can only say, yeah, that's true. This is one of the reasons that the study of this culture is so challenging. So I mentioned the Phoenicians turning up in the Bible. This goes back to more reasons for Phoenician economic prosperity. They're engaging in a kind of service economy because Phoenician sort of architects or construction contractors are hired to work on projects, including the temple in Jerusalem. So this is a very kind of commercial society. It varies from city to city, but overseas trade is a very big part of Phoenician society. And probably the best example of this is the city of Tyre. Tyre is actually on an island, not like out in the sea, you know, it's just off the coast, but it's a classic kind of port city with a large merchant fleet, well-developed harbor, lots of structures for like the sheltering or even repair of ships. It's got commercial contacts all over the Mediterranean, and we know that the kings of Tyre personally owned or were part of the consortium that owned. They had these sort of commercial consortium called a hubur. They were like ship-owning syndicates, and the king participated in them. Indeed, maybe you had to have the king as a member. I'm not quite sure about that. But anyway, we know that the kings of Tyre were involved in huburs that owned dozens of vessels of various sizes. Like, I think one of these examples talks about the king having 70 ships, which is a pretty substantial investment. We're talking about merchant ships here, not warships, but these cities also had substantial war fleets, and militarily, they were definitely more, especially in the early part of the period, in the Eastern Mediterranean, they were definitely more kind of naval in their military focus. Although, not to say they didn't have land armies. As Carthage developed into something more like an imperial power, the land military of Carthage, its personnel, come from all over the empire, which is not surprising at all, but we can imagine that we might be in societies where most of the land troops are either some kind of, you know, colonial subjects, foreign auxiliaries, or mercenaries, while the bulk of the citizen troops, you know, whatever that means, speaking of other things we don't know very much about, the political organization of Phoenician cities, but the bulk of the kind of troops where people who are born and raised in the city are fighting, they're probably on ships. Now, that maritime expansion led to Phoenician or later Punic presences, not just in Lebanon and surrounding regions, but in places like Cyprus, Rhodes, Crete, Sicily, Sardinia, Italy, Malta, North Africa, Spain, Morocco, the Balearics, and although they didn't permanently settle there, maybe even as far away as Britain or the Canary Islands. And there's some evidence that Phoenician navigators were interested in getting more detailed knowledge about the navigation of Africa. As I said, we're looking at a wide-ranging commercial society involving a lot of autonomous city-states. Some of them, especially in the early part of the period, are ruled by what seem to be hereditary monarchies. And we know that the rulers of those hereditary monarchies were closely connected to the religious institutions. Not something I'm going to talk about in great detail in this episode, but we do have examples of powerful religious leaders being relatives of the king, or even the king being also a high priest of some kind. But we also have some evidence that there may have been ones, particularly again, like Carthage, had more of a sort of oligarchic quality to it. May have been a little bit more like Republican Rome in that respect, with a Senate representing noble families. And there's some suggestion that, you know, wealthy merchants and ship owners may have made up that body. So we do see the names of different kind of governing or legislative assemblies, but what exactly their role is in society is a little tricky to figure out. Again, we know very little about their politics other than what we learn from outside, which is A, not always that detailed, and B, maybe not always that reliable. But as I said also, they are often under the thumb of one of the big empires, although those empires tend to leave them to operate largely autonomously as long as they pay their taxes and don't mess with the overall policy of the empire, which is, of course, something that they not infrequently do. So they're not particularly loyal or obedient subjects, and there are numerous instances of various Phoenician cities rebelling against or being somewhat fractious subjects of these big empires. Also, when we talk about religion, we may be looking at examples of a more broadly shared kind of Near Eastern religious framework that we would find not only in the Phoenician world, but also in what is today Syria and in other parts of the ancient Near East. And indeed, as we go through some of these Phoenician deities, you're going to see some overlap with our previous season about Sumerian or Assyrian or Babylonian religion. So I said earlier that there's a strong connection between government and religion, and also that each of these cities is governmentally autonomous from the others. So that means that we're going to see a religion which involves a kind of shared conceptual framework and shared ways of approaching the gods, but in which the deities that are prominent in each city are very different from each other, and in which they are, you know, believed to have particular associations with particular cities. Now, obviously, there's a good deal of overlap, not just some overlap, and there's even some duplication, but you wouldn't necessarily expect to find that the same religious, well, not the same practices, but the same cults existed in the same way in every city, because those were so connected with kind of concepts of that city's identity. Which means that rather than having a lot of deities with different conceptual responsibilities, we have a lot of deities with different geographical responsibilities. Those gods also have different conceptual backgrounds in a way. I don't want to make it seem like they're all just like, here's God or here's goddess. But another issue with learning about Phoenician religion is that the Phoenicians do seem to have been a little bit reluctant to produce representative images of their deities, which, as we know, is also a trait that they share with some of their neighbors during this time period. There are illustrations of various Phoenician deities, but it's not always very clear how representative they are of how Phoenician culture saw these deities in general, since they often seem to be influenced by examples of religious art from other parts of the world. So there'll be representations of Phoenician deities, but often in a style that is inspired by Egyptian art, or it's inspired by Greek art, or whatever. So there's some adoption of foreign artistic styles to do something representing gods in a human-like form that Phoenician art doesn't characteristically do. And then, of course, there is just a lot of overlap between these cultures anyway. These are, you know, these commercial outpost cities are very kind of cosmopolitan. And I don't think the Phoenicians are caring very much about enforcing kind of cultural boundaries. So again, I don't think these images were necessarily controversial. It's all a bit complicated. But we're definitely seeing a strong vein of local importance in Phoenician religion. It's such that gods are tied to particular cities or are considered to be very important to those cities. Now, we've seen something like this before in the world of the Sumerian city-states, where we're looking at separate polities, which nonetheless have kind of one of them that's in the most prominent position, rather than an empire in the way that we would understand it. And we know that, you know, the Assyrians didn't particularly care about enforcing worship of their particular deities on any of their subjects, and same goes for the Persians. These are all cults that would fit reasonably comfortably into the religious understanding of these cities' overlords and conquerors. For an example of a deity who's very closely connected with, like, the health and success of the city, take one of the Phoenician gods that we're going to be talking about in a future episode, Melkart. So Melkart's name comes from two root words, and we've seen one of them already. Remember when I said that Carthage is Kart Hadasht, new city? Kart means city. So the second part of Melkart's name just means city. And the first part comes from a word that we've actually had reason to talk about previously on Monster Man, rather than on Patron Deities, though we may have talked about it on Patron Deities as well. And that is the root Melk, which means king. And a corruption of that word has been put forward as the origin for the name of the devil or evil deity Moloch, whom we talked about in a previous episode. I said at the time, I'm pretty sure I just accepted this theory, the idea that Moloch is what's called a dysphemism, a way to say something and make it sound bad. So Phoenician doesn't have written vowels in it, right? A bit like Hebrew. I actually don't know enough about the language to know if that's true today, but biblical Hebrew doesn't have vowels written in it. You just know what the words are and fill them in. And so one theory is that the name Moloch is a dysphemism using the vowel sounds from a different word, which Bosheth, is that the word I'm looking at? You know what, I don't know this off the top of my head, but the idea is that if you pronounce Melech as Moloch, it has the vowels of this other word, and it makes it sound unflattering. It reminds the Hebrew speaker of this word shame, which is to say Melech, Moloch's more like, which if you're a certain kind of person from a certain place and time, that joke is extremely funny, I'll have you know. Anyway, that's not my point. My point is that that's probably not the case, and actually Moloch probably comes from a different root, which means sacrifice or offering, and therefore maybe one of those cases where there actually isn't a deity called Moloch, but the practice of sacrifice is called Moloch. Who knows? Anyway, we're also going to see some other familiar deities that we've run into previously. So when we talk about Astarte, that's going to overlap with things we've said previously about Inanna. And did the Assyrian / Babylonian section have a separate Ishtar? I think so, right? But like Astarte is in that mix, is and isn't Ishtar or Asherah or whatever. In the Cthulhu Mythos section, I'm pretty sure we talked about Dagon. Dagon is, in fact, a deity from this neck of the woods. He is the god of the Philistines, who I don't know if they are Phoenicians, but they, you know, in a sense, be seen as culturally similar to or related to Phoenicians. So we got Dagon in there. We've talked about a few of these deities in the past. So I think that a lot of what this season focuses on may not be the specific deities about whom comparatively little is known. So to pull just one example, we'll talk about him at a later time, but Reshef is sometimes called Reshef of the Arrows, and there is one illustration of a deity in a kind of traditional Egyptian art smiting pose, and that is often understood to be Reshef, although I believe that the identification is not 100%, but it's just an interpretation. And consequently, people sort of think like, well, Reshef's the war god. So that guy, for all that we are going to talk about him in more detail later, I don't know that we're going to get a whole episode out of him. And instead, we're going to focus on the ways in which we can get inspiration from Phoenician religion, and in particular, Phoenician like religious practices within their city-states. You know, how can we take things from that and use them in fantasy role-playing games? So despite not just like my comparative lack of knowledge about Phoenician religion, but the comparative lack of knowledge about Phoenician religion, I still think that there's a lot that we can learn from this culture for games, and I'm looking forward to sharing it with you as we proceed in upcoming episodes through the world of Phoenician religion right here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.